The opinions and statements expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WWDB, its staff, or management.
Good day, everyone, and welcome again to another edition of Boomer Generation Radio. This is your host, Richard Address, coming to you from WWDB AM 860 here in the Delaware Valley and streaming live on WWDBAM.com. And again, a reminder that if you want to reach the program with some ideas, suggestions, etc., just email us at boomergenerationradio@gmail.com. That's boomergenerationradio@gmail.com. We have an action-packed show with you this morning, and we're going to be welcoming as our first guest Rita Pollack from beautiful Tucson, Arizona. And I hope Rita is there. Rita, are you there?
Beautiful this morning.
Hi, Rita. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
Good to speak with you. We're going to be back with Rita and to talk a little bit about her work and collaborative divorce and mediation and some of the rather interesting statistics that are coming down in studies about what's going on with our families as baby boomers. But first, I want to bring you this message from the Samaritan family of senior care, and they've asked me to remind you that if you're concerned about your parents' failing memory, if you're concerned about your parents' safety at home, and you're not quite sure where to turn for help, we urge you to contact SeniorWise. SeniorWise Geriatric Care Managers, a very, very important program here in the area. SeniorWise Geriatric Care Managers. They can provide a comprehensive assessment and care plan to help keep your loved ones safe at home, screen and monitor in-home services, and help you avoid costly mistakes. They can also ease your loved one's transition to a care facility if that becomes necessary. SeniorWise is a member of the Samaritan Family of Services, and to speak with a SeniorWise geriatric care manager today, call them at 856-552-5166. It's 856-552-5166. Mention Boomer Generation Radio. And you can log on to them as well at www.seniorwisecare, one word, seniorwisecare.org. The number again is 856-552-5166, www.seniorwisecare.org. It's a pleasure to welcome to the microphone here and the station at WWDB and Boomer Generation Radio, Rita Pollack, who is an experienced collaborative family law attorney, a trainer, a mediator, and a facilitator, a past president of the International Academy of Collaborative Professionals, and a co-founder and first president of the Massachusetts Collaborative Law Council. She's been on the faculty of a variety of places and has spoken, I know, all over the world on this issue of collaborative law and collaborative law practice. Rita, welcome to Boomer Generation Radio.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I want to start with this interesting report that it keeps resurfacing in a variety of news outlets. The latest one that I bumped into was something on from NPR. As a study titled, All Americans' Breakups Are Causing a Graying Divorce Trend, and a statement that the post-World War II generation, our generation, is setting new records for divorce. Americans over 50 are twice as likely to get divorced as people of that age were 20 years ago. Rita, what's going on?
Well, I don't think that really should be a surprise to us, and I've noticed that trend in my own practice over the last 10 years. In fact, it became so noticeable to many attorneys that it's a feature at a lot of the legal conferences that we go to. They're special workshops on how to help seniors and boomers go through this life cycle. And it has become a new life cycle event for boomers. It almost has become normative. So it's not a surprise. Life changes when you hit certain ages. And I have found that when people hit certain milestone ages, whether it's 50, 55, 60, 65, that birthday sneaks up on them, and they start to take stock. And because we live much longer and we stay healthy and robust and active much longer, people look ahead and they say, I might have a good 25 or 30 years left, and I really want to do something different with it. And it becomes a catalyst for change, so it really isn't a surprise.
So this longevity...
I think the boomer generation has always been about change and changing what's normative.
Do you think some of this is just change for change's sake? I hate to sound cynical, but...
I don't think it's change for change's sake. I think it's very sincere. It's deeply held. It's extremely emotional. The decision to leave one's long-term marriage and spouse and family and friendship community is a very difficult decision to make. But I can remember clients of mine who would hit that birthday and they'd come back. They'd say, I went away for a long weekend all by myself right after my 65th birthday, and I realized that there was so little passion and energy left in our marriage that the interests which had held us together, mainly around the kids, were just not there anymore. And we'd sit over supper and have not much to say to each other, and it became desultory, just kind of blah. And I think boomers have been conditioned not to accept blah and to look for something which is much more fulfilling. And I don't mean that in a superficial way. I mean that in a very deep way.
I imagine when you work with this population in this situation, there's all kinds of different, or maybe I'm wrong, with different perspectives. I mean, you're dealing now mostly with adult children, aren't you?
You are.
Yeah, so.
You are.
How does that affect the difference between somebody who chooses to leave a marriage with kids, you know, who are either, you know, in elementary school or maybe tweeners or something like that? I imagine it presents a whole series of different challenges.
Well, it's very different. If you're divorcing and you have young children, in fact, those young children still connect you and keep you together. And you end up co-parenting in most cases for a very long time. And so you end up actually still being partners in some way and being in contact with each other and going to events together, you know, ball games and rehearsals and recitals and graduations. And you kind of figure out how to navigate those things together and to navigate both families, both sides of the family, staying together and connected for the sake of the children. On this end, as you've said, the children are grown. They've already struck out on their own. They have their own families, and it almost becomes a cycle. Now it's perhaps grandchildren that are at the forefront, and how are you going to be together with your grandchildren with perhaps your former spouse? And I've seen cases where it's almost like a revolving door. You know, the grandmother comes in one weekend and she spends time with the kids and she leaves, and then the grandfather, perhaps with a new wife, comes in and spends time with the kids. So it becomes complicated, but in a different way.
Yeah, the whole grandparenting phenomenon with the subsequent marriages and relationships, not necessarily marriages, but long-term committed relationships, cohabitation amongst older adults, which I know is growing.
Yeah,
because I'm involved in some of that work in my own aging work, and I know this co-parenting thing. That could you just there's a woman who was on the show here a couple of months ago, Roseanne Vanella from FamilyAffairs.com, who also does a lot of what you do. And her next issue of her website, coming out in April, is going to address co-parenting issues. The difference between, could you just walk this through a little bit more? The difference between co-parenting with younger children and this issue of adult children and then being a divorced grandparent.
Sure. I think the co-parenting with younger children actually requires a tremendous amount of communication. And I think that's unexpected. When people divorce, they do have this fantasy that they're going to go off and create a whole new life and leave the other person, for the most part, behind and in the past. And when they're young children, we know that's just not true. The children are the bridge that keep those people connected for many, many years. So for some people, there's not daily contact, but there may be contact several times a week as the children are going back and forth, as you're having to confer with each other about medical decisions and healthcare decisions and vacations and holidays and who has them the first night of Passover and who has them the second night of Passover and what do we do about Thanksgiving this year and where will we sit at graduation so that everybody can feel comfortable. It's quite intense. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, for the adult children, in some ways, it's actually up to those adult children what kind of boundaries and limitations they want to set on their parents and how much contact they want to have with their parents and how much they want to invite their parents into their own lives now with the grandchildren. And as you've said, there are now these new relationships, and we don't even know what to call them. So you've got grandma and grandpa. And sometimes there are two or three of each, depending on whether or not this was a first marriage or a second marriage, which broke up. And then you do have these long-term cohabiting partners. So do the grandchildren call you grandpa and your new partner by her first name? Does she have children? Does she have grandchildren? I mean, those family reunions and those big family occasions can get very unwieldy and uncomfortable. But it really is the adult children who now become the gatekeepers.
I imagine you mentioned the vocabulary. I seem to sense, and I like your opinion on this, that as the society moves forward with all these different familial constructions, we may need to create some new vocabulary for all these various relationships, because just grandma, grandpa, step-grandma, step-grandpa may not work.
I think that's right. I think we are going to explore new vocabulary, new ways of thinking about things and relating to people. And, you know, sometimes people use pet names or they make up names or they just use first names. It's rare to hear step-grandmother and step-grandfather that feel so formal or mm-hmm. half parent or half brother or half sibling. Those things have kind of faded away. But there are creative ways where families start to designate who's who. And most children adapt. They just follow the parents' lead. So that's why these adult children become critically important. And I think it's navigating the relationships with them and making them feel like they haven't been abandoned that's so important. I know a lot of parents who think that they're going to divorce decide to wait until their children go off to college. And honestly, that's one of the worst times to do it.
Why? Because that's very normal.
It seems like that would be a good break, but
right.
In fact, it's not. I mean, just think about it. Young people, 17, 18, 19 years old, still struggling with their own identity, still struggling with what do relationships look like for me, and wanting to come home to that, at least for the first year, to that stable setting. They don't want to come home from that first Thanksgiving when they've been away at college and not know whose house they're supposed to go to, or to find that their family home and their family community where they grew up has been sold, and now all of a sudden each parent is living in a funky condo on the waterfront. This doesn't feel good to them, and it doesn't give them that continuity that they need so that they can break away. It's almost become a reversal. The parents are breaking away, when in fact, developmentally, it should be the kids who are breaking away. And kids are very confused and hurt, and it makes them look back over all those years and say, were my parents just staying together for me? And they don't like that responsibility. So I know that parents are doing this with very good intentions. It makes lots of sense to them when they're thinking about a natural time to get divorced. But it can have pretty serious consequences for young people.
So I guess then I have to ask, is there ever, in your experience, is there ever a, quote, good, unquote, time to get divorced?
I suppose developmentally there are better times. You know, if children are super, super, super young and are very adaptable and can get into a new rhythm and routine and the parents can co-parent in a respectful way, then it's easier because the kids can kind of just go with the flow. There are times more around the 8 and 9 year olds when it's difficult, but not quite so difficult. But I think once you get into the teen years where kids are really struggling with who we are and what does a loving relationship look like, that's a hard time.
Hmm. We're talking with Rita Pollack, a collaborative family law attorney, a trainer, mediator, facilitator. We are talking with Rita here on Boomer Generation Radio, and we'll be back with Rita in 1 second. But I want to take this opportunity to remind you of a very good friend of the show's, the Hecht Investment Group. The Hecht Investment Group of Janney Montgomery Scott, which provides concierge financial consulting and planning services. The Hecht Investment Group uses a formal investment process as their foundation and assure that clients receive frequent communication and rapid response to questions. As many of us know, there are no needs greater than our own when it comes to personal financial planning, especially at this stage of our life. The Hecht Investment Group provides experienced guidance and an efficient management process that is important in today's environment. Contact the Hecht Investment Group toll-free at 855-289-2168. That's 855-289-2168. Or visit thehechtinvestmentgroup.com. And the Hecht Investment Group is also on Twitter, LinkedIn, and in Facebook. And it's a pleasure to remind you that the Hecht Investment Group and Peter Hecht has been recognized in Philadelphia Magazine and the New Jersey Monthly Magazine as a 2013 five-star professional wealth manager. And again, that number is 855-289-2168. Mention Boomer Generation Radio. That's the Hecht Investment Group. We're back with Rita Pollack, a collaborative family law attorney, trainer, mediator, facilitator, raconteur, worldwide speaker on this issue, literally all over the world, and Austria and Ireland and Israel, all over the United States. Past president of the International Academy of Collaborative Professionals and a co-founder and first president of the Massachusetts Collaborative Law Council. Rita, what is collaborative law?
Well, collaborative law is a way for parties who are divorcing to be represented by counsel and to settle whatever disagreements they have between them out of court. So it's not mediation. Mediation is something where the couple sits with someone who's neutral and doesn't represent either one of them. This is a different process where the parties are actually represented by their own independently hired attorneys, but the attorneys are specially trained and very, very trained. We spend a lot of time making sure that we've got our skills really up to snuff to help the parties settle their disagreements. And we're problem solvers. We work together. We all sit at the table together, and we walk them through everything that they need to know and do in order to get divorced without going to court.
All right. So I want to explore this. Walk us through a little bit more detail the difference between mediation, because these are both terms that are being used now. Mediation, yes, versus this collaborative law. If I'm in mediation, my spouse and I come to the two of us sit with one person, or
that's right. So that's what. And so if you can picture this, it's like a triangle. The two parties, you and your spouse, come to this neutral person who's been trained to listen to you and to help you resolve your issues, but can't give you legal advice. Even if they are an attorney themselves, they can't represent either one of you, and they can't give you legal advice. So you're really being asked to sit down at the table with your partner just at the most difficult time in your life, when you're probably barely speaking to each other. And you have to advocate for yourself, and you have to help yourself reach an agreement with this person that you're probably just furious with, or at least very upset with, and probably not communicating very well with. And your attorneys are not present with you. They may be in the background advising you over the phone or at a meeting, but they don't come to the mediation with you. So it's this little triangle conversation. In collaborative, you hire your attorney who's been trained to help you resolve your issues, and all four of you are at the table, and everything is open and transparent, and there's an agenda for the meeting, and everybody's ready to get down to work, and there are no recriminations, and the attorneys are not pulling against each other and advising their clients to do the other client in. It's actually quite the opposite. I advise my clients to be generous, to be caring, to be kind, to bring whatever goodwill they can muster to the table, because you cared about this person at one point, and if you have children, you're going to be connected to them in the future. So this is not the blame game. This is how can we create a new future that's healthy for both people at the table, and the attorneys support them in that work. We often add mental health professionals to the table who act as coaches who help the clients communicate more effectively, and they're trained in the collaborative process. And we also add neutral financial professionals who are working for the benefit of both parties. So again, there's none of this your camp, my camp. So we're all in this together to get this done so that we can lay the foundation for a good future for both people.
So walk me through very quickly the training, because you're saying a collaborative. If I'm a lawyer who specializes in this collaborative law, mm-hmm. I have to undergo a special training process. Is that
you
correct?
You really do, yes. The training is very important because, remember, all of us who went to law school were trained in the traditional adversarial system. We were trained to think in a particular way, to analyze, and to look for facts, and to look for how to take advantage of those facts against the other party, and to put on our armor and get up on our white horse and defend our own client. And you have to set all that aside and learn new skills and habits that are more problem-solving and more collaborative and cooperative. So just an initial basic training is 3 full days. And after that, there's a series of advanced trainings, which take place in all the communities where there's collaborative practice. And there is collaborative practice in Philadelphia and in Harrisburg and in other places in Pennsylvania. And you could go on the IACP website, collaborativepractice.org, and pull up Pennsylvania and find out where there are collaborative practitioners. And you can be sure that they've been well trained in this process, that they've taken the basic training and advanced training in higher communication skills, in helping people determine what their interests are and their needs are, as opposed to just what they want to have and got to have if they're feeling vengeful. And so it's a very serious process, and we hold ourselves to a very high standard. And the process is really successful. I have to say that it's been around for more than 20 years, and easily 98% to 99% of our cases settle to the satisfaction of our clients, and they don't have to go to court and have a judge impose anything on them.
So if somebody listening wants to explore this, give me the website again that
collaborative practice,
www.collaborativepractice.org.
Correct. And that's the International Academy of Collaborative Professionals website. And in it, there are all the countries where this practice is happening. And within that, there are all the states. And so you can just go in and look for Pennsylvania,
or New Jersey,
or Massachusetts, or Ohio, wherever you are, and drill down into the community that's closest to you.
That is in New Jersey as well?
New Jersey, for sure.
Okay.
Maryland, D.C., everywhere.
Good for New Jersey.
You got to put in a plug.
No. It's in Jersey. You got to make sure.
Yes. In fact, one of the board members, the current board members, is from New Jersey.
What led you to this?
Well, real frustration with traditional practice. It was never intended to encompass family law. You know, traditional common law practice came out of the English system, and it was really designed to protect the king and feudal lords from serfs. So it's a very land-based, property-based system. And then it came to all the other Commonwealth countries, including the United States. And it fit pretty neatly into the criminal justice system because that is about blame and finding fault. But pulling families apart at a time when they are in such desperate pain was never a good fit. And it became a worse fit as we understood more about the psychological needs of families who are separating and divorcing and the psychological needs of children and how complex they are and how long-lasting they are. And even judges don't always feel well-equipped to deal with things which are more psychological and emotional in nature, and then think about it from the other perspective. It's not really a legal issue whether or not the children are returned to a parent at 6 o'clock or 6:30. I didn't go to law school to become a judge to make that decision, is what we hear from judges. Mm-hmm. Or who gets the teacups and who gets the tea saucers. These are not legal issues. These are issues that have other meaning attached to them. And they're better suited to a negotiation conversation where people can really say what's important to them and why it's important to them and explore that and make decisions which aren't forced on them by the legal system, which is so narrow. So it really has developed, I think, to meet the needs of the clients. And the boomer generation, I think, is always out in front of what's happening and what's new.
We only have about 2 minutes left, and it just sparked a question. There are reports we're seeing now that millennials, those people in their 20s, early 30s, really are shying away from marriage. Do you think that's a result of the rise in divorce in the United States and amongst their parents' generation, or do you think this is just something that will change as they themselves get older?
Well, no, I think there has to be some impact. Now, think of yourself as a young child, and your parents are divorced, and you're 5 or 6 years old, and from the very beginning, your primary relationships have become fragmented. So you're spending Monday, Wednesday, and Friday with one parent, and Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday with the other parent, and you've got your little suitcase and your backpack with your soccer ball, and you're going back and forth. And your model for what an adult loving relationship looks like has been split into two homes. And you've got to figure out for yourself how you're going to live a life living with a primary loving relationship in one home. And you haven't had that experience necessarily. Although a lot of people do remarry and they're very successful, and children of divorce are very successful. I think it's made them tentative.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that makes sense. And so they're getting married later. Still getting married, but getting married later. And I hear a lot of them say they really want to wait to be sure that they can make that commitment. They would rather not repeat the divorce pattern, although we know statistically that often they do.
Well, the whole trend to older, I mean, delaying things, we're seeing certainly in our community, and I think in many places from the census is telling us in a variety of different, in all communities, delaying marriage, delaying child rearing in many cases.
Yes.
And it is significantly changing the society. Well, before we go, and we're just about out of time for this segment, Rita, give me that website again in case somebody wants to contact the IACP.
Thank you. It's www.collaborativepractice.org.
We've been speaking with Rita Pollack, past president of the International Academy of Collaborative Professionals and co-founder of and first president of the Massachusetts Collaborative Law Council, on this whole issue of collaborative law and divorce in America, and the rise in baby boomer divorces. Rita, thank you very, very much for being with us on Boomer Generation. Have a great day out there in Tucson. Enjoy the warmth and enjoy the sun. Something
thank
that,
you.
It's a rare experience back here in Philadelphia.
Thank you very much.
And just
good
take care. Be in touch with you soon. Thank you very, very much
okay,
for being with
care.
Us.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye. Again, you're listening to Boomer Generation Radio here on WWDB AM 860 and streaming live on WWDBAM.com. And once again, let me remind you that if you have a comment about the show or suggestions, please feel free to email us at boomergenerationradio@gmail.com. The whole baby boomer phenomenon, you know, as we've been talking about the baby boomer divorce, et cetera, really opens up such a wide parameter of the experiences of our generation and many of the things that we're going through. To comment on that, I want to remind you of another friend of our show, 50andbeyond.com. 50andbeyond.com is a content-based website for the baby boomer and senior populations. This comprehensive website covers a wide range of topics, including health and wellness and financial and legal services, senior services, lifestyle, leisure styles, as well as real estate and design services. You can also find fascinating stories on the local and national and global stage that relates to our generation. 50andbeyond.com is committed to connecting you with the most highly qualified and respected professionals in the greater Philadelphia and South Jersey region. And once you are on 50andbeyond.com, be sure to sign up for their informative newsletter. You can also check out their community calendar for special events in the greater South Jersey and Philadelphia region. 50andbeyond.com also offers a free Ask the Expert page where you can ask your own personal questions on an array of topics and get answers straight from these experts. And if you hate sitting and reading off a computer screen, we ask you don't worry about that because 50andbeyond.com has you covered. Paired with the website, 50andbeyond.com also produces a free bi-monthly printed magazine. Distributed to over 200 area locations, this magazine is perfect for active adults on the go. Find it at your local supermarket, your library, your doctor's office, and many other local businesses. And if you can't seem to find a copy, you can download it directly from 50andbeyond.com or get a copy sent straight to you by emailing info, that's I-N-F-O, info at 50andbeyond.com. 50andbeyond.com simplifies the lives of baby boomers and seniors, so log on today and find that information that matters to you. That's 50andbeyond.com. Welcome back again to Boomer Generation Radio on WWDB AM 860 and streaming live on Boomer Generation on WWDBAM.com. And again, the website to contact us is boomergenerationradio@gmail.com. And it is a pleasure to welcome you to the Kendall segment of Boomer Generation Radio. This portion of Boomer Generation Radio is brought to you by Kendall, a not-for-profit system of communities and services located in eight states in the Northeast, Mid-Atlantic, and near Midwest regions of the United States. Kendall advocates for and empowers older adults to reach their full potential and is committed to working with others to together transform the experience of aging. To learn more about Kendall, which is K-E-N-D-A-L, visit Kendall.org, K-E-N-D-A-L.org, or call them toll-free at 888-759-0128. That's 888-759-0128. Mention that you heard about them on Boomer Generation Radio. And on our Kendall segment of Boomer Generation, we want to welcome Lori Flynn and Gretchen Cole. Ladies, are you still, are you there?
Yes, we are.
Yes, we are.
Great, great, great. Lori Flynn is the director of nursing at the Kendall in Hanover, New Hampshire, and Gretchen Cole is the assistant living administrator for Kendall in Hanover, New Hampshire. And we welcome you to Boomer Generation Radio here on the Kendall segment. And we wanted to begin a conversation because this is not a conversation that's going to just take a half an hour. This is something that is becoming more and more and more present within baby boomer generation and dealing with ourselves and our parents. And that's this whole issue about Alzheimer's and dementia. And just to start this conversation and lay the foundation, could you define the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's?
Yes, this is Gretchen, and I'd be happy to start us off. Dementia can be defined as the loss of mental ability that's severe enough to interfere with normal activities of daily life. It can be defined as a group of symptoms that is caused by the general death of normal brain cells. And there are approximately 70 types of dementia, with Alzheimer's disease being the most common.
And so Alzheimer's is sort of like the most advanced form of dementia?
I wouldn't say most advanced, but it is the most common form of all of the dementias that are listed, meaning the majority of people have it.
Okay. So I have to jump in because this just broke on the news yesterday, and I made notes and somewhere have a newspaper report of this study that was a release, I think, from a couple of universities. I think Georgetown was one of them, but this blood test to determine 2 or 3 years ahead of time whether a person will develop Alzheimer's. Can you comment on that?
This is Gretchen again. I did read that article, and I think that it's it's a great step in the right direction. I think that, as the article pointed out, there still is more testing that needs to be done. And but I think that it will certainly help with diagnosis and will also probably relieve some fears that people have once they have that test done.
What do you mean relieve the fears? Because I know there's a huge fear factor now.
Yes, there is. Well, I think that there's a general fear of people who maybe already have a relative with Alzheimer's disease. They wonder if they are going to get it. They can wonder for really a long time if they're going to develop it.
Is there a, you know, just looking from your involvement on the ground floor, I mean, you're basically dealing with individuals and families every single day. How do you counsel a family when they come to you and or about to place someone in the facility that they know that they're on that slope? What can you walk us through some of the conversation and how you deal with that?
Yes, I can. We're very much an interdisciplinary team here. So there are a number of people who are involved in the process, including nursing, social work, and our clinic staff. So when we've had this type of communication with the family and begin those discussions, it's really centered in on the individual and how we can best meet their needs and help with that transition. Everybody goes through the disease process differently, so we have to look at everybody as individuals. Somebody who may really transition into the extra care that they need in this memory center, you know, might totally differ from somebody else who really needs us to break it down into stages and steps and begin introducing them to the memory care center in a variety of different ways, just basically by visiting or asking them to volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
When they do become a resident of the memory care center, we still continue to assist them with the transition. We continue to offer support to their families, again, through that interdisciplinary team. And we really encourage families to support one another. They've already been through the transition. They can be a great support to somebody else.
Lori, you're the director of nursing at Kendall in Hanover, New Hampshire. Do the nurses that you're working with who are dealing with the memory unit and dealing with individuals who are working themselves through dementia and or Alzheimer's, do they require special training, or is there a special approach to this?
First of all, let me know what I should be addressing you as. Well, is it Rabbi?
No, just Richard is fine. That's
just
fine.
Richard?
Yeah, it's fine.
I think we will be getting to that question when we talk about when it comes time to choosing a community, and maybe we can continue on with some of the general information regarding dementia.
Well, let me approach it from a different perspective. I hear so many people, you know, contemporaries of mine, we'll be having a conversation, and they'll all of a sudden forget, they can't retrieve something right off the top of their head, and they'll say, "Oh, I'm having a senior moment," and then they'll have this flash of saying, "Oh my God, is this what's going to happen to me?" What could you just, you know, tell us a little bit about the difference with, you know, somebody has a so-called senior moment. They can't put their fingers on something, a fact right away. I mean, it comes maybe a minute later or 30 seconds later. That's not a definite indication that they're on this path of dementia, is it?
No. There is a scale, a 7-point scale, that is used to summarize when an individual has cognitive impairments that are consistent with dementia. It's called the Global Deterioration Scale or the Riseberg Scale. And it's a scale when the first point on the scale, or number one, is a person with no cognitive impairment. The second rung on that ladder is somebody that has those senior moments, that are not consistent with cognitive impairment. It's not considered a problem with dementia or cognitive impairment until you get to the third scale of that, the third ladder on that scale, and that is considered mild cognitive impairment. And then 4 through 7 are consistent with dementia on that scale.
Is it true that everyone, as they age, the natural process of aging, there's going to be some cognitive decline? Is that a fact?
It is a fact that normal brain wear and tear, you do get some cognitive decline. It may be just that word finding, name finding, just those kind of things. That, you know, you wake up in the middle of the night and then you realize what needed to surface to answer a question.
So, and there's also, because we have to compress a lot of this in a half an hour, there's also this studies, I see this a lot in magazines and sometimes on other media, that you can ward back, keep that tide of cognitive decline from really getting stronger by constantly, obviously, staying active, exercising, and doing brain, like crossword puzzles and that type of stuff. Is that a myth or is that actual fact?
That is actual fact. Diet, exercise, and brain fitness. And brain fitness to the level of maybe learning a new language or really exercising your brain to its fullest.
You mentioned diet. Talk to me about that. How does diet impact brain function and decline?
Diet is important because you want a diet that is low in animal fats, high in vegetables and fruits, and you want to make sure that you have your omega-3 oils, and that's pretty much it as far as diet.
So, in other words, for those of us down here in southern New Jersey and Philadelphia, less steak sandwiches.
Oh, yeah. No Philly cheesesteaks there.
Let's watch it. The Chamber of Commerce is going to, you know, they know where how to get you. I want to remind our audience, you're listening to Boomer Generation Radio here on WWDB AM 860 in Delaware Valley. And we're speaking with Gretchen Cole, the Assistant Living Director, Administrator, rather, at Kendall in Hanover, New Hampshire, with Lori Flynn, the Director of Nursing at Kendall in Hanover, New Hampshire. And this segment of Boomer Generation Radio, as a reminder, is brought to you by Kendall, a not-for-profit system of communities and services located in 8 states in the Northeast, Mid-Atlantic, and the near Midwest regions of the United States. And Kendall advocates for and empowers older adults to reach their full potential and is committed to working with others to together transform the experience of aging. And again, a reminder to learn more about Kendall, that's K-E-N-D-A-L. We invite you to visit them at kendall.org or call them toll-free at 888-759-0128. That's 888-759-0128. Again, this is Boomer Generation Radio on WWDB AM 860 here in the Delaware Valley, streaming live on WWDBAM.com. And to contact us, just email us at boomergenerationradio@gmail.com. Lori, you mentioned before that idea of when people seek entrance into a facility, what those caregivers, they are going to come to you knowing that this is a major life transition that their family and their loved one is undertaking. What do they look for? How do they begin to handle that very, very difficult process?
Richard, I would like to give you some good news before we get to that segment of the talk this morning, and that is there are some conditions, medical conditions, that can present with memory loss or present as a cognitive decline, but aren't treatable. And oftentimes, a depression or hormonal imbalances like thyroid hypothyroidism or Cushing's disease, or certain infections, a urinary tract infection or pneumonia, or deficiencies of vitamins, especially vitamin B12, can present as a person with cognitive deficits. And if treated, if identified and treated, those memory problems can resolve.
That's good to know. Thank you. That's very good to know. So walk me through then, before we start zipping out of time here, from your perspective, Lori, that caregiving concern.
I'll let Gretchen take the lead on this one.
So, Richard, just clarify for me again. You'd like to know what the role of the caregiver.
Right, right. You know, that they're presenting, they're coming to you, they're dealing with a very, very traumatic moment in their life. How do you begin to, as the administrator of the assisted living program, how do you begin to deal with this, the caregiver approach?
Again, everybody is different and is individual. And it can vary. So, if a child has a different experience, in my opinion, than a spouse does when they are having their family member come into the memory care center. So we design an individualized plan for the family member, and that can be not only related to their health, but how they would transition, making sure that we know as much about their life history as we can. And this goes from where they went to school to simply how they drink their coffee in the morning, or even if they like coffee in the morning. So we do all of these things. We try to continue to keep the individual linked to the community so that they don't feel stigmatized or segregated in any way. And I do a lot of communicating with the families. I will either call or send an email within the first 24 hours and let a family know how the first night went, and encourage them that they can call the nursing staff at any time to get an update. And we do a lot of communicating within the first weeks or the first months, depending upon how a person transitions. And during that time, there's a lot of reassurance given that things really, they really are okay, and the staff are trained to provide this type of care, and they really do a tremendous job in helping with the transition.
So communication, that's important for people. Does every Kendall facility have a memory care unit?
No.
So you have one in Hanover.
That's correct.
And off the top of your head, do you know which one of the other ones do?
There's about three. The one that comes to mind is the Admiral in Chicago.
Okay. And again, not every, from my experience as well, not every assisted living facility has a memory care unit. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So it really is part of the research of a family to find the appropriate and qualified memory care units in their particular area.
Yes.
So one of the other, then that begs the question then, how does a family then know when it's time to make this move? It's a very, very traumatic moment. When do they know that they really have no choice but to place a loved one in a facility?
Richard, it's Lori Flynn.
Right.
And oftentimes we talk about that global deterioration scale.
Mm-hmm.
When the individual with cognitive impairment reaches about stage 5 or 6, that person is needing help with all activities of daily living, with finances, with transportation needs, and may be exhibiting some behaviors and may have some problems with incontinence. Usually when this wandering where caring for your loved one with cognitive impairment and they are wandering and up night and day,
mm-hmm.
It really stresses the care person, the care provider. And if you add in maybe some resistance to care, maybe incontinence, then it really becomes a strain on the caregiver. At that point in time, it may be time to look for help in a community setting.
I've heard from families that I've dealt with, you know, in a pastoral counseling sense, that occasionally somebody who really is exhibiting advanced signs of dementia or Alzheimer's can have a certain violence associated with some of that behavior. Is that true?
Yes, it is. And oftentimes it comes out of frustration because the behavior is a form of communication.
Ah.
And it's a matter of trying to figure out what that person is trying to communicate.
Do you mean, the person who starts to act out this way in some primal level is aware that their ability to communicate is hampered and this may be the only way that they can express an emotion?
What I would say more is that they're expressing a need. And it may be that there's pain. Maybe when I try to help you put on your clothes, maybe you have pain and you're unable to tell me that. And so you strike out at me.
Oh.
Or maybe you have you're wandering and trying to seek because you think you need to go home to prepare a meal for your children coming home from school. So there's communication with behavior, but it's the trick is trying to find out what that communication is.
Yeah, and I, for the caregiver, it's very. I mean, I've spoken to people in my clergy role as pastoral counselor that the caregivers themselves feel a combination of guilt and frustration that they can't understand this and it concerns them, and yet they don't know what to do sometimes.
Absolutely.
Let me ask you another, the both of you a question, because we're making an assumption that the person that I'm caring for is local. What happens, I'm sure you've run into this because families contact you, what happens given the mobility of everybody today that I'm not living in Hanover, New Hampshire, I'm living in Boston or I'm living in Philly and I get the word or somebody calls me from the apartment next door that this is happening? How difficult it is to maneuver this long distance. It must be very, very difficult.
It is very difficult, and I can speak from personal experience on this particular topic. I had a mother living in another state and could no longer live on her own. She was having trouble with finances and driving, and I met with my brother, who luckily was nearby, and my mother went to live with my brother. There are organizations now that do case management and can help with that, because it's very, very difficult trying to manage, especially when it's a different state and it's a parent or a loved one.
There's this rise of geriatric care managers. One of them is one of our sponsors in the first segment, Samarin. But I imagine across the country, this rise in the need for geriatric care managers is really, really important, given exactly the scenario that you just painted.
And I think we're going to be seeing a lot more.
Wow. It's just so fascinating and frightening at the same time. One of the caregiving issues that I keep hearing about and have seen reports on, and I've actually posted some of these reports on the Facebook page of my website, jewishsacredaging.com, is that true, from your experience, that we're going to run out in the next 20 years of really competent, qualified caregivers to deal with dementia and Alzheimer's?
I think it's going to be very challenging to care for all of the baby boomers that are coming on down the pike.
No, they're here.
They're here. And also with the people living longer with dementia and caring for people with dementia.
Well, and how do we begin as a society? You know, like I said, you're on the front lines. you're dealing with this every day. You see this every day. You see the family dynamics played out every single day. And if what you're telling me is true, and all the reports that I've seen are alerting us to this fact, how do we as a society begin to even deal with the fact that there's not going to be enough qualified people to take care of me when I'm 92, God willing?
Richard, I think that the one thing that I would recommend is that we all be patient and understanding. There's such a variety of forms of dementias and the type of assistance that people need. I don't want to set people into a panic, but I also think that people can really support research and funds, because that's one of the ways that we learn about the disease. That's one of the ways that we provide training to staff members and how they can take care of somebody, and also encourage our young people to enter into healthcare fields in different ways to help support this need that's going to continue.
I would imagine also to help to push the idea of urging people and physicians to have some specialties in the area of geriatrics as well.
Correct. This is Lori, and I also think we need to look at be creative in our resources and look at community-based services, look at adult day programs. As I said earlier, my mother was in Massachusetts. They had a program there that was an overnight program where you could take your loved one, your family member with dementia that tended to wander at night, and at least if they went to the night program, they could have safe wandering and supervised wandering so that the caregiver could get rest, restful sleep, and then be able to provide care and services for that person the next day.
Yeah, I think, Lori, you opened the door to a conversation that will eventually, I want to continue this conversation on this subject, the whole idea of really creative new ways of individuals as our generation ages, how they will choose to live together. I think this is something that's going to happen. I think we're, like you're saying, alluding to it, just beginning to happen now, and people thinking very, very creatively about different forms of living arrangements to be supportive with each other. And I think, look, this is something that we want to explore on a future edition of Boomer Generation Radio. We've been speaking with Lori Flynn, the director of nursing at Kendall in Hanover, New Hampshire, and Gretchen Coley, administrator of the assisted living program at Kendall in Hanover, New Hampshire, here on the Kendall segment of Boomer Generation Radio. Lori and Gretchen, I want to thank you very, very much for joining us this morning, for really enlightening us and giving us lots to think about and setting the stage for what I hope to be, I know will be a major consideration of a future Boomer Generation Radio. This is too important just to leave to just a little bit. So, Lori, Gretchen, thank you very, very much. I appreciate you being on with us. Have a great day up there in New Hampshire. And to all of you listening, thank you very much for listening. We'll see you same time next week on Boomer Generation Radio, WWDB AM 860 in the Delaware Valley. Have a great day.
Thank you, Richard.
Bye-bye, ladies. Thank you.
Bye-bye.